You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RSA. I'm Jonathan Rowson. My job title's in constant flux, but I lead our work here on climate change. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you all this evening to what should hopefully be a great and quite unusual event. I've been working on climate change for about 2 years now. Our work is supported by the Climate Change Collaboration, and we work with COIN, the Climate Outreach and Information Network, in developing this current project called the Seven Dimensions of Climate Change. Now, why seven dimensions, and why have we taken that sort of framing of the problem? Well, basically because, as some of you know, climate change is hugely complicated, complex, difficult, big, global. It's about the past, it's about the future, it's about the young, it's about the old, it's about men, it's about women, it's about the global south, it's about the global north, it's about technology. It's kind of a mess. It's after a while, it becomes almost unbearable to think about. For some people, it's very, very simple. We just need to do X or Y. But for every person you find who says it's simple, you find someone else telling you how complex it really is. So what I did one day was I was thinking, given all these factors, I remembered a quotation of Einstein who said that we should make everything as simple as possible, but not simpler. And that was the challenge. How can you bring climate change down to a certain number of elements so that you capture the integrity of the phenomenon, of the problem, of the challenge, but you don't reduce it so that it's not meaningful anymore, so that it's no longer the real thing? You have to keep it real, but keep it real in a way that people can remember. And in that sense, it's quite useful. Some of you might know, for remembering, there's a good rule of thumb that we can remember seven items quite easily without too much trouble. Seven is a sort of, in your working memory, you can hold seven items, plus or minus two, depending on how good you are, but typically it's seven. And so I thought, what would seven aspects of climate change be? So I came up with this framework, and then since then we've been developing it, and even now we're developing it. It's not a sort of final product. It's a new way of thinking and talking about the world's, perhaps the world's biggest challenge. So it starts with the science, as you might well be aware. Science tells us the nature of the problem, tells us how urgent it is, tells us with almost unanimous agreement, or at least a very strong consensus, that this is real, it's happening, it's caused by human beings. If left unchecked, it will continue to get worse and significantly harm our habitat in ways that are potentially devastating. They also tell us that there is scope to act. There's still time to significantly mitigate the effects of climate change. There's a reason to stay involved. There are things we can do. And then you have technology, which in one sense is our great hope. I spoke to a colleague earlier today saying, just tell me quickly what you feel about climate change. And he said, well, I have great hope, great faith in technology. And a lot of people do. But for every person you find who has great faith in technology, you have someone else who feels that technology is actually driving the problem. Most of fossil fuel infrastructure is driven by technological developments. So technology is both part of solution, part problem. And then, of course, many of you will know we have a big Paris International Summit later this year, where the world's great and good gather together to try and thrash out an agreement that will hopefully save the world, quote unquote, in the sense of actually reducing carbon emissions significantly across the globe. And that's really a challenge of law at some level. It's about getting a constraint at scale. The purpose of law, what law can do that nothing else can do, is stop things happening and make things happen at scale, en masse. So law really, really matters. But why will people change the law? Well, where does the pressure to change law come from? It comes from us, really, which is democracy. It comes from actually people putting pressure on their elected representatives, in theory at least, to make those commitments and get those laws. But for every time someone says that, you hear someone else saying, well, hang on, what's the impact on the economy? Or what are the economic mechanisms through which you can make that democratic change? So economy is another key dimension. So we already have four. We have science, technology, law, and democracy. But then you have this issue of, well, it's not so easy somehow to change democratically. What do we hear about climate change? How often is it on the news? How often do you talk about it with your mates? How often do your teachers raise it in class? So there's an issue of culture, of where it is in our culture, how it's spoken about. For a long time it's been, is it happening or isn't it happening? And we need to move quite quickly to a place where actually it's not a question of if, it's a question of what. What do we do? And that's partly what tonight's about. And there's also behavior. There's the issue of ultimately, what do we do? You know, ultimately, it's an action challenge. What are we called upon to do? People are always saying, it's time to act on climate change. And then someone else says, yeah, but how exactly? You know, what exactly do you want us to do? Especially at the individual level, a lot of us feel that. So that's the kind of broad context. And that's where we are, and that's sort of part of what I'd hope would inform tonight's speakers. But why young people? Why ask, get the schools involved? So thanks to RSA Academies for bringing forth so many of you tonight. Thanks to the Climate Change Collaboration for bringing forth our young speakers later. We wanted new voices because we think that every one of these dimensions has a claim to be the fundamental one. The scientists can say it's all about us. The lawyers can say it's all about us. The politicians, it's all about us. The population can say it's all about behaviour. All of them have a really strong case for being the most important thing. But they obviously need to talk together. And the more we can do that, the better. But to do that, we need a greater cultural consensus about how to speak about it and who should be speaking about it. And the who is key. Because until recently, climate change has been mostly an expert discourse. It's been about scientists or politicians, somewhat aloof, somewhat elitist, saying, this is what's going on, this is what we have to do. And it hasn't really worked. It's been relatively stuck for a long time. So the challenge now is, how do we get more voices, different modalities, different ways of speaking and acting, different feelings, actually, different emotions? And that's what we're hoping to give voice to tonight. So that's the scene setting. But the first thing tonight is the young people from the academy. So Brodie Clark is a Year 8 student from RSA Academy in Ipsley. Molly McNamara is a Year 9 student from RSA Academy in Whitley as well. Sorry, in Whitley, excuse me. Erin Green is a Year 9 student from the Trinity Catholic School in Leamington Spa. Louis Mertens is a Year 12 RSA Academy student from Arrow Vale. And Kobir Ahmed is an A-level student from RSA Academy in Holyhead. So first of all, give them all a round of applause for being here. Okay, thank you. And then I'm going to sit down and then an individual round of applause for Brodie Clark.
Our world is slowly crumbling and we're doing nothing about it. We need to change our feelings, no matter how deep down they might be, into actions, because that's what's going to make a difference. And that's why we're all here today, to make a difference. Since the 1950s, the amount of carbon dioxide in the air has gone straight up, and it's not stopping. We need to stop relying on our fossil fuels, as they will run out sooner than later. I suggest we rely more on solar panels and wind turbines, as these create no pollution whatsoever. Alternatively, hydroelectric power is suitable for our situation. When carbon dioxide is released into the air, it traps heat, causing a problem we know today as global warming. This means our ice sheets are melting and our world's biggest ice deserts are all fading away. And what will be the result of this? Well, our water level will rise a considerable amount. We see parts of South Asia in the monsoon season and the flooding is horrific. Who's been to the south coast here? Well, imagine that a lot closer to home. Imagine having to tell your children about the mysterious place that once existed, but is now buried under unstoppable rising tides. We are all responsible for this. And all of this because we're too lazy. Our behaviour as a whole needs to change. We need to start cycling to work instead of driving, or even car share. Little things like recycling can make such a big difference. And regular people like myself can do the best we can by saving electricity. Or even maybe save up for an electric car. Yes, it's something we're trying to save, but it's a lot healthier and better to use than petrol. Which brings me to my next point. Our scientists need to stop wasting time on unnecessary vanity projects. They need to start inventing new schemes to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide and pollution in the air. I suggest a new law should be enforced so that all the countries, counties and households around the world are encouraged to reduce, reuse and recycle. For example, our school has been fundraising so that we can afford to have recycling bins placed all over our school. Over time, we will have saved a huge amount of paper. Not only would this enable the children to do this, but encourage them to learn about it in the process. Like I said before, we're here to make a difference. And if we all go off and do our own thing, I guarantee nothing will be done. We need to unite as one gigantic community instead of putting in a half-hearted approach. Imagine a world where people don't have to move house every couple of years because it's being flooded, and where everyone is happy. This will be our planet in years to come if we put our minds to it. I have faith in every single person here because I know we all care. And after all, we are the people of tomorrow, and if we don't do anything today, soon there will be no tomorrow.
Is climate change an old topic? Yes, it is. So, ladies and gentlemen, it comes as no surprise that climate change is majorly affecting our planet, which means that it's imperative that we start coming up with solutions to help stave it off. If we continue to ignore this growing threat, there will be intense storms, droughts and ocean acidification that will irreversibly damage our planet. There are many different factors to the solution, like changing human behaviour, scientific research, technology, law, democracy, culture and the ever-growing economy. If we take time to consider each and every aspect of these things, we could be on our way to saving Earth. Humanity has come a long way since the creation of our planet, but it has gotten to the point where our behaviour is having a serious negative impact on our chances of survival. Many of us are ignorant towards our environment. We are in denial. This denial helps us avoid the problems that will eventually lead to the ruin of our planet. We also tend to discount the future and focus on having everything here and now. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that just the meat industry alone generates nearly one-fifth of human greenhouse gas emissions. This demonstrates exactly how the never-ending demand for things is having a negative effect on everything. In my opinion, this is one of the most important factors of climate change, as we all have different personalities, so changing our ways would take some serious persuasion. The niche theory could help us, however, it would need to be carried out on a massive scale. Also, the mass increase in population over the last 50 years is contributing to the depletion of fossil fuels. One way to tackle this problem is by introducing the one child per couple law as seen in China. This would slow down the resource expenditure, however, many people may disagree if they want a large family. Another thing that is contributing to climate change is the economy. Many corporations depend on fossil fuels to power manufacturing plants. Businesses need to stop relying on fossil fuels and turn to other methods of supplying energy. We have discovered many ways of extracting energy from the earth without damaging it, like wind power, hydroelectric power, solar energy, biomass, biofuel, and geothermal energy. At the Paris talks, the delegates representing China could possibly disagree about the economy causing climate change, due to the fact that this country produces most of the CO2 emissions. In 2014, China emitted 35,270,000 kilotons of CO2, probably due to its colossal population and economy. Democracy all over the world could make a stand against this issue. Governments need to act first to encourage their citizens. Australia had a fossil fuel tax which reduced CO2 emissions. However, this tax was scrapped due to it being unpopular with the public. If all countries introduced this tax, the world could be on its way to recovery. Laws like fining people for too much waste in their green bins could be introduced, as it would encourage recycling largely. The scientific community could also aid us. They have come up with many solutions, but never put them into action. For example, they have made replacements for fossil fuels, like ethanol derived from crops and hydrogen electrolyzed out of water. None of these have become immediately available at the scale at which we need them. However, if scientists improved and expanded on these ideas instead of constantly warning us about global warming, we could have many different amazing solutions within our grasp. Along with the scientific community, developers of technology could also lend a helping hand. The idea of geoengineering technology to help the Earth is still theoretical, but the ideas that people have come up with could be possible with the right funding. A possible theory includes deflecting the sun's heat away from the Earth's surface using solar shields or satellites with movable reflectors. Computer design suggests this would deflect 8% of the sun's radiation, which would counteract the warming effect of CO2 pollution. Overall, climate change is a colossal dilemma, and if we don't do something soon, we may as well start looking for another planet to live on.
Reasons, in my opinion, why it is so hard to solve the issue of climate change. One of the main ones is apathy. It is true to say that people are generally more bothered about the economy than they are with climate change. The current debate about climate change has indicated that although many people believe that globally climate change is happening, only a minority believe it to be a very important problem. This collective apathy means that governments, prioritising re-election, seek to deliver quick solutions that do not involve sustainability. The environment suffers in the short term and humanity still suffers in the long term. It has been said that if the world fails to take action on this planetary emergency, over 100 million people will die by 2030, a mere 15 years away. Luckily for us, it's not too late. But if we continue to justify our inaction with excuses, our impact on the planet will become irreversible. Our behaviour as a worldwide community needs to change. A global solution is the only way to achieve success. Individual, local solutions, whilst valuable, do not have enough impact. This is not about more recycling bins or a tax to promote responsible practice. Whilst individual behaviour change is incredibly important and will be the vehicle that drives positive change forwards, what is needed is international, innovative, systemic, intellectual change. My recommendation is that governments engage strategically with universities and higher learning and commit a minimum percentage of investment on research and development to solve issues of climate change. This is not simply optimism, but an investment in the people who can make the greatest difference. National political solutions have been found that have a limited impact. For example, the Australian government began using the carbon tax in 2012. The strategy that companies have to pay money per tonne of carbon released into the atmosphere could have been a vital success, but in a strange way, it created climate change sceptics, became a vote killer, and was actually counterproductive. This is a clear example of why it is so hard for governments to solve climate change. However, the fact still remains that our governments need to cooperate, focus, and work together globally to solve this problem. We have all witnessed how quickly nations can unify when they need to condemn terrorism, or support charity, or indeed go to war. We all share a world, and for many countries, climate change is already a matter of life and death. Our leaders need to stop trying to blame each other and arguing over who should be spending the most money and effort on climate change. We need them to change the way they run things, the way they prioritise issues, and the way we all collectively deal with them. We already have some incredible scientists, and there are generations more to come, not forgetting the unbelievable amount of technology. There have already been so many good ideas. It is a fact that Apple is now worth more than the entire Russian stock market. If just half of the workforce and money of companies like Apple were put towards solving the biggest issue of our future, well, you can imagine the impact. As a member of NATO, the UK commits to spending at least 2% of GDP on military expenses. If we could agree on spending this amount of money on combating climate change, the results would be astonishing. We are a race committed to and successful because of innovation. Imagine a world where the research capability of our great privately owned IT companies could be used to combat climate change. I'm not trying to be arrogant. I know that thousands of people have already worked tirelessly and millions of pounds have been spent on trying to deal with climate change. But the first step is for us all to acknowledge that climate change is happening. The second step is working together to create and implement a strategy that spends an appropriate amount on research and innovation so we can find effective solutions. Beyond that, we have the ability to ensure a sustainable future.
Who are you? Who are you? Who am I? Who are any of us? Who we are is a group of people who are on the same page. We are all concerned about the ever-increasing implications of our presence on this planet. Would we be here otherwise? All of us share a desire for change, but if that change is not realised, civilization will perish. But who are we? There's no definition complex enough to justifiably define the human race. We're individuals. We're each so bizarre and wonderful in comparison to one another that it's truly amazing that we've met here today to share this common belief that tomorrow shouldn't be the day the earth dies a little more. We have been this way, not just you or me, but those before us, for thousands of years. It was estimated by Dr. Claire Patterson in 1953 that the earth is around 4.5 billion years old. Humans, people like you and like me, as we are today, have existed for just less than 200,000 years. To put that into perspective then, if you consider the average lifespan of a person in the UK to be around 83 years, that would mean, in proportion to that life, we've been here, our entire species, as we know it today, just 32 hours. It could be said then that our species is in its infancy. And yet, in our first 32 hours, we've raised pyramids, put a man on a rock orbiting 385,000 kilometres away from the Earth, and written collectively almost 130 million books. We're children. Our species are still children. Children did that, and just like actual children, we bicker and we fight, albeit on an international stage over politics and geography. Just like actual children, we're still discovering new things every day with increasing regularity. And just like actual children, we're making incredibly poor decisions with regards to our world's health. We're binging on its natural resources, and the spots are beginning to show. In the last century, the Earth's temperature has risen by almost a whole degree centigrade. Greenland is losing ice at an ever-accelerating rate, almost 200 billion tonnes per year, and the Maldives are steadily drowning. But where does the responsibility lie? Should it be down to the European Parliament? Why? When Europe, according to the US Environmental Protection Agency, only contributes 13% of global greenhouse gas emissions? Or should it be down to the United Nations? Or should responsibility lie with individual governments around the world? Probably. It's their call, it's their law. The key word there, though, is individual. After all, it collectively is the 7.1 billion individuals that make up 100% of the greenhouse gas emissions. And I know you're sat there thinking that you can't possibly contribute to the 36.7 billion metric tons of CO2 produced every year and forced into our atmospheres. But do you recycle everything you can? Is your home fitted with double glazed windows or LED lights? Or do you buy local produce? Or do you fuel the demands for cheaper goods from foreign countries? But who am I to tell you? I'm clearly not an eco-warrior, but then I'm not asking you to be one either. In fact, the term today is a cliché. At the end of the day, it's not eco-warriors who are going to make the important changes in our world. It's those who change their lifestyles to better suit the planet, those who examine their behaviours, adopt small changes and maintain those changes. These decisions could be made in industry, government, education, or just at home, but at the heart of every situation sits an individual who must make a choice. I'm asking simply this: if that individual is you, don't do what's easy. Don't act without regard. Do what you know will have the most favourable impact on our future. A single individual acting independently won't make a change. A single individual didn't build the pyramids. A single individual didn't one day land himself on the moon. And nor did a single individual write the 130 million books which make up our world's libraries. But we know that it took 25,000 single individuals to build the pyramids of Giza, around 400,000 to land two people on the moon, and easily hundreds of thousands more to create 130 million books. So, you tell me, why can't 7.1 billion single individuals prevent global warming? You tell me.
A generation from now, historians and scientists will be trying to contemplate as to why we were far more concerned with issues such as terrorism, capital wealth, and global recession than we were of the approaching environmental apocalypse. Everybody recognises the existence of climate change, yet very little tangible action has been initiated to reduce and mitigate its effects. The blame ultimately falls upon us, the most ungrateful, selfish and irresponsible species that this world has ever had the greatest misfortune of ever accommodating. Whilst other creatures can live in harmony with the Earth's environment, we relentlessly consume without thinking of any repercussions this may have on our future. Unless we utilise our collective knowledge to steer ourselves in the right direction, global tipping point is inevitable. But how can we continue to live a way of life without producing significant proportions of greenhouse gases? Fact is, we can't. Far more research and development is required by our scientists. Geoengineering techniques to combat climate change, in theory, can work. However, they potentially could have negative impacts on ecosystems which humans are dependent upon for survival. Carbon sequestration, for example, may affect the monsoon seasons that happen in India and Bangladesh. And although India now is a large contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions, Bangladesh currently isn't. And the legitimate argument is that if they haven't caused the problem, why should they be the ones to pay for it? There are many reasons as to why countries decide not to take any action towards climate change. Many countries aren't to blame, so they choose not to do anything at all. Other countries believe that specific countries are more of a problem, so they should be the ones to deal with it. But the major reason is that many countries believe that their economies will suffer as a result of their actions. Governments need to focus their energy towards a cause worth fighting for. Governments need to stop behaving as schoolchildren, playing the blame game and arguing about things such as America and China being the problem when they are the ones who benefit from the economic activities. Take the US, for example. They emit the most CO2 emissions in the world, but without them, we lose out on $54.8 billion worth of imports. If the US stopped emitting CO2, the world economy would be completely decimated. So it's not as simple as punishing the US or China because it's their fault. A way around this problem would be shifting and altering our present system of economic practices to a more sustainable model, which still prevents pollution yet allows economic growth. The Stern Review, for example, estimates that 1% of global GDP spent now would avoid the worst impacts of climate change, yet predictions indicate that 20% of it could be lost if no action is taken. Now, it's natural for countries to want to develop themselves, just as how we did during our Industrial Revolution. Leading economists are predicting that the economies of India, China, Brazil and South Africa will continue to grow rapidly and could potentially eclipse ours. These countries are on their way to becoming the next economic powerhouses of the world. However, we must not allow unchecked development. These countries must learn from the mistakes that we made and develop in a way which is sustainable. It's no good the MEDCs reducing all of their emissions and the newly industrialising countries taking their place as the world's largest CO2 factories. Otherwise, our work just goes to waste. The solution to this problem is MEDCs sharing their resources and technology with the less developed countries and newly industrialising countries so that they can develop in a way which won't have a detrimental impact upon our environment. The Kyoto Protocol was a failure. Despite 190 countries choosing to take part, which was ineffective as the countries producing the most greenhouse gas emissions, US, China and India, decided not to take part as it was their belief that it would affect their development and economic activities. The US, according to The Guardian, produced 6,885 million tonnes of CO2 in 2008. And if they don't take part, why did you do it? All of your work has just gone to waste. The Copenhagen Accord wasn't useful as it wasn't legally binding, meaning that countries weren't by law entitled to follow it. If it was legally binding, it would mean that the countries would have no choice but to follow it, and then we might actually see some real change in attitudes towards climate change. Now, I have family in Bangladesh, most of whom are subsistence farmers. When their crops fail, we send them money to keep them going until a new harvest can be made. However, no money I can make or my family can send will stop Bangladesh from being under the sea in 20 years' time. Bangladesh is a delta. It's a low-lying area of land formed when a river deposited material, but the sea never washed it away. It's one of the largest population densities in the world, and 80% of it is low-lying, and most of it is predicted to be under the sea. Now, that's my heritage, my ethnic origins, completely wiped off the face of the planet because we couldn't be bothered to help them. If money was invested to reduce global emissions, this would eventually lead to a deceleration in global sea level rise. This is what we call an investment for the future. Prevention is far more better than cure. The truth cannot be concealed. The events of not accepting climate change and taking action will be severe. 90% of coral reefs die, which are huge ecosystems giving safety to hundreds and thousands of species. 53% of Arctic tundra will be destroyed. Global crop yields will reduce by 10%, which you might not think is a lot, but imagine now how many people are dying due to starvation. The Siberian ice sheet will melt, releasing 2 million tonnes of CO2 into the atmosphere. 200 million people being permanently displaced. This is the unfortunate reality of our situation. It's our lives, our world, our problem. Steve Jobs once said that the ones that are crazy enough to believe that they can change the world are often the ones that do. Change the world. And please, I don't want you to clap for me. I just want you to think. Just think about what you can do and think about everything we've said. Thank you.
No.
Good call. Authoritative call. Well done. So, Kobir rightly said that it's a good time to think. So take 30 seconds. And after 30 seconds, I'll come back to you. And now, I'd like you collectively to thank Brody, Molly, Erin, Louis, and, if you want minds, Kobir. And can I invite up to the stage, please? Again, I'll introduce you collectively before you all come up. As a bridge, we've heard wonderful talks from five, not very young people, there are younger people, but school pupils. We heard from the things that jumped out at me, broadly speaking of one gigantic community. It's quite an evocative term, one gigantic community. Because, you know, in some ways we are that and yet we're not that. We're a million fragmented small communities as well. But in some ways, on this issue, we at least, we have to try and be one gigantic community. Molly spoke a lot about denial and discounting the future, which is absolutely at the heart of the climate problem. And denial is a very complex notion. I got to this problem by thinking of just how complex it is. It's not just about saying the facts aren't true. It's often accepting the facts, but living as though they weren't there. What we call at the RSA stealth denial. So we have, it's like an open secret. We know it's happening, but we act as if it's not. Erin's said beautiful, many beautiful things, but perhaps the most evocative for me was the issue of climate change being relatively unimportant. People often say the issue is how important is climate change? It's so important. But when it comes to the crunch, when it comes to acting, the issue is not how much people think climate change is a big deal. It's about the relative trade-offs. It's about climate change vis-a-vis education, defense, health, economy, and so forth. So climate change is never an issue by itself. It's always mixed in with these other things. I think it was Louis's comment, tomorrow shouldn't be the day the Earth dies a little more, which is probably, if anyone's on Twitter, that really should have gone out there. And hopefully it will be going viral as we speak. And then Kobir, of course, said many powerful things. But it's great just to bring it home to like real lives, real people, real families, real communities that are under threat. And there is a problem thinking of this in the UK that we only ever think of it as a UK issue, but of course it's very much global, and it's not an equal global issue. It affects some places more than others. Okay, so that was my take home. But to hear what other people thought, we're going to invite up. We have two relatively vocal climate change campaigners, activists, as they're sometimes known. Miriam Wilson, come up, Miriam, and Gitika Bardwaj. I hope I've got the pronunciation right. And we also have Caitlin Falasco, who's a a passionate professional working in sustainable housing, and we have a concerned citizen, you know, the sort of speaking the voice of the people. We have Jolo, and I'd like you all to welcome them. So, first things first, I'm going to ask you what you thought of what you just heard, and we'll begin with Maria.
It's interesting, when you started out, you kind of brought climate change down to these 7 key points, and then as soon as the speakers came up, it just like explodes into a huge range of like different topics and controversial statements and things that I really agreed with and felt really like emotional about, and other things that I was like, no, I disagree with you. And you know, there's just like, it's just to me, it brought home like, wow, this is an amazingly complex issue.
Sure. Yeah. Julie, what do you think?
For me, it just really stressed how important it is and how passionate people can be because it's so important. And yeah, that was the kind of take-home message for me.
Yeah, I'm just absolutely, totally impressed with the knowledge these kids have and all the scientific facts. They've been educated well.
I'm just as hopeful that such young people can be as passionate as we were when we were young too, about lobbying our decision makers and feeling so passionate about our planet that I think, you know, it gives me so much hope, and I find it so inspirational that you could be so knowledgeable, so talented, and you can speak so passionately about it. So I'm hopeful about the future.
Okay. You're hopeful about the future. I think it's fair to say probably not everyone is, right? Is that fair? That it's not you, it's some part of the reason we're having this event, part of the reason this issue is live, is that a lot of people are quite concerned. So, I mean, Kobir spoke about a whole country being effectively annihilated. So it's a very real, gritty issue. And part of what tonight's about is the narrative that says, if young people, it's our future, you know, you've got to look after it because we're the ones who'll inherit it. That is two things. One is it's kind of a cliche, and the second is it's true. Part of the challenge is precisely that. So what I'd like to get a feeling from you guys is from, you're just somewhat older than, I mean, I'm feeling very old tonight, I'm 37, but you know, it's one of those nights where you feel your age. But as people who are sort of a generation or so younger, Jill, I'll start with you. We spoke of this in the context of culture and who is speaking. So what's your reading of who is speaking at the moment on the climate issue and how that needs to change?
I think it's mostly kind of middle-aged to older people who tend to be, you know, have the good jobs in the media because they've got the experience and stuff. And I think, I personally think the idea that it's in the future and the young people will inherit it, and it's kind of a cop-out, I think, saying it's their problem. Whereas, you know, it's happening now, especially in some places, like we had the floods, and that's happening now. So, and also some people sometimes say, oh, I don't want to have grandkids, so I'm not bothered about it.
Right.
And we don't want that excuse.
No, we don't. So it's not, you know, it's not some people in the future, it's everybody now.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyone else want to add on that in terms of your perception of the culture and who's speaking about this? Miriam, it looks like you have something to say.
Yeah. I mean, sadly, like, there are so many voices on climate change that are just not being heard. And
which ones?
I mean, particularly the voices of the poorest people in the world who are suffering the effects most strongly. I mean, you know, when we see like an extreme weather event that hits a country in the global south, like where are the voices of those people? What are they saying about climate change? It's something that we're starting to hear a little bit more now recently, but I think it's the privileged elite that run our media.
Sure.
Don't let those voices come through, sadly.
And right. Gitika, you were recently at the climate talks in Peru. A lot of attention at the moment. We keep on waiting for something to happen at some level. Everyone's kind of waiting for this big climate change event to transpire that will galvanize action. And at the moment, the main contender for that is the Paris talks towards the end of this year. Having been in Peru and hearing what we say in the context of hope and fear, how are you feeling about the chance of people around the world agreeing on something tangible later in the year?
So you probably gathered I'm a bit of an optimist. So I feel a mixture of emotions. When I was in Peru, I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of national delegates, and I heard mixed responses from them. Some of them were frustrated with the process, even though they had been in international negotiations on climate change for many years. They said it's the same thing, you know, people bickering about a word in the text, for example. And then there were other people who were more hopeful that more could be done if they just lobbied enough, if their voices were loud enough, if they got the right momentum on certain issues. So I took that away with me, and I think ahead of Paris, I think so much can be done, so much is being done. We see it all the time in terms of renewable energy. We're seeing records being broken from the private sector. We are seeing national governments commit to climate change legislation. I think something like 62 countries have climate laws nationally. So I think so much can be done, and I do believe it will be done, but we need the momentum there. And I think things like having young people talk about these issues and having the stage to talk about them is exactly what's needed. So, yeah.
All right. Caitlin, we've heard a lot of people, when the earlier speakers, talking about small-scale actions that individuals can do, often in the household. What's your take on that? I mean, is it enough for, you know, recycling is mentioned a lot, but those who know climate change well will recognise that recycling is merely the most salient, available, commonly understood and experienced aspect of the environment as a whole, but when it comes to the enormity of climate change, it's very much the thin end of the wedge. So are there any things you think can be done at the level of homes and people's consciousness of the issue more broadly?
Right, here's the thing. So recycling is sort of like a gateway into sustainability. So if you're doing that on a level from day to day, it's a very minor commitment that you make. But something that's going to actually make a difference is maybe getting involved in your local politics, and something that's going to be much more influential. But it's still important that you're confronted with those minor decisions every day, because they become the new normal, the new behavior that's accepted by everyone. Right. So if you and your neighbors, which are actually a huge influence in housing, whatever your neighbors are doing, how's my neighbor's lawn look? If you and your neighbors have to dispose of your trash in a common area and you see each other, or you see a meter for your house, then they're holding you accountable for your energy performance, for things like that. So there's more effort by the housing designers of the future to sort of make that sort of metering thing standard, make more of a visibility and an accountability for people that are living in their homes, and making more of a community environment. Because right now, in, say, London, we're living on top of each other, but some people don't even know our neighbors. Mm. And what's going to make you behave differently if you don't even know who you're affecting next door, right, let alone in the world?
Right. So we know from behavioral science that, you know, the social norms are really important influence on behavior. One of the biggest reasons you do something is because somebody you know or like or respect or just happen to be around is doing something different. But you're saying that's a challenge when actually you don't know most of the people around you. And you're also hinting there at a certain possible stigmatization, potentially, that you're saying that, look, part of the problem is that pumping carbon into the atmosphere is still socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. We don't see it as a shame, stigma issue. Could we ever get to the point where that, A, could be the case, or B, should be the case? Anyone who wants to take... Miriam, you're quite an energized political person. What do you think? Do you think there's a place for shame in this, or is that, should we keep it positive, keep it happy, or is it something where you have to get a bit edgy?
I think for me personally, like, the guilt that's been associated with individual behavior change when it comes to climate change has been such a burden. So like when I was a teenager, I felt like so guilty about the idea of like going in a car or buying something that I threw away, that I just like wanted to shut out the issue. So for me, like, now I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I know where the shame should lie, and it's with the companies that are digging up the stuff that we are burning and throwing into the atmosphere. So fossil fuel companies like Shell and BP, they're the ones that are making record profits. They're the richest industry on Earth. They're the ones that have the stakes to keep climate change happening and to keep digging the stuff out of the ground. So for me, I'm done with like feeling ashamed about occasionally like using a plastic water bottle, and I'm all about like targeting that industry.
Because what I sense from the earlier speeches as well, there is a tension. A lot of people want to say it's about us. We have to change our ways. But what you're saying is actually that's not really the case. That's a sort of maybe even a smokescreen. We've actually, it's a very political statement, but actually there is an enemy in a sense in the climate issue. Now, there might be the enemy that's giving us the quality of life that we value. It might be precious. It might be very hard to change. But you're still saying there is a clear target. And I believe you've done some work relating to the divestment, which is a very big, hot issue of the moment. We know that the UN have come out saying it's time to take money out of fossil fuels. The Guardian corporate body describes itself now as a global digital business that happens to print a newspaper. But the Guardian have now said, look, it's time to divest in fossil fuel stock. Is your view that that's the way forward, or should we still rely on small behaviours, or is it both?
Yeah, well, of course, like, ultimately we all will and have to change our behaviour, ultimately. And, you know, one of the attacks lobbied against the divestment movement is, you're hypocrites, because we all use fossil fuels every day. But, yeah, definitely, I think divestment and the divestment movement and the climate movement that's coming out of it are the way forward on this issue. Primarily because it's so accessible. We all have we all belong to public institutions. If it's not like a school or a college or a university, then it's a local city council. And a lot of those institutions have money which they invest. And a lot of that investment is likely to go towards fossil fuel companies. So by pulling that money out of these companies and saying no, there are both moral and financial reasons not to put our money into a future that is going to end in catastrophe. By doing that, we can hopefully build the political movement that we need to withdraw the power away from these companies, that they have a stranglehold over our democracy currently.
Okay, thank you very much. So I want you all to stay on the stage and stay with me. We're hoping we'll hear from you again at the end. But for now, I want to bring back the room. And if you can, take your some of you know each other well. We have parents, teachers, and pupils from the same schools. And we also have people who don't know each other. So if you just take 5 minutes to try and, you know, talk amongst yourselves about what you've learned, and we'll come back in 5 minutes, and I want to take the sort of best point from each table. Okay, welcome back. One, we've just heard that there's some important people in the room who need to catch a train, and that's Whitney's school. So we're going to ask Whitney's school first for their thoughts. And who's going to speak from Whitney's school over there? Yes.
I'm Louise. We think that the five schools here, if they go back and see where their electricity comes from, so if it comes from turbines or burning fossil fuels, if they go back and change that to a more efficient and better way, that will make a huge difference. And if you think these five schools done it, why can't the rest of the schools in Coventry or London or wherever in the world? If one school changes one thing, why can't everyone else?
Great, thank you very much. If you pass the mic to Abby here, just in the right in front of you, thank you. And yes, please.
Yeah, hi, I'm Kabir, if you didn't know. Okay, we were thinking more along the lines of personal and cultural as well as technology. So we think the way forward is with the technology. I mean, it's no good we changing what we do and then the fossil fuel companies or the oil companies keep pumping out oil. We think technology is the way forward. I had an idea of fusion power. Right. I mean, it's dangerous, but it's the way forward. I mean, if you
what do you mean by future power?
In fusion power, I think it's when you hit two neutrons together.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But that it's kind of like nuclear fission.
Right.
But opposite.
Do you want to invest in fusion?
Investing in the technology to do it really.
All right.
Is the way forward.
Okay. Thank you very much. If you pass the mic over to this table, thank you.
Hi, I'm Louis.
Louis, no Shakespeare this time. Okay. I'm just kidding.
Our table's like a mixture of Ipsley and Aravel and a few relations. But we've kind of come to the consensus that it's an equal responsibility between ourselves and industry, because I think originally a lot of us thought that it was our responsibility to reject a lot of the kind of the bad things that would affect climate change, but it's also the industry's responsibility not to give these opportunities out for us to reject them in the first place. So it's an equal responsibility between all of us, and we need to be given the opportunity to voice our opinions, but we shouldn't just focus on the costs of climate change, but rather the benefits of the solutions.
Sure. Yes. So there was a positive. So thank you very much. If you pass the mic around. So that's very important. We often speak of climate change always as problem, never as catalyst for positive vision of the future. So thank you. Yes. If you can introduce yourself again, thanks.
Oh, I'm Francis. We think that it shouldn't be enough just to acknowledge responsibility in the West for industrialization and the causing the majority of the problems in the climate change, that we need to listen to alternative views from the rest of the world where they haven't industrialized to the same extent.
Greater contribution from voices from other than the Western industrial
places world. That really understand about sustainability and haven't gone down the road that we have, and that we should listen to alternative views.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And pass it. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lisa. We really like the idea that people shouldn't feel guilty about going to Primark or using bottles, and that even though we should do things individually, it is a collective idea and it is the responsibility of large companies, and that people should make their voices heard rather than dwelling and having a stigma around our lifestyles.
Thank you very much. Tim, do we have anything from Twitter, Tim, that we want to share? No? Okay, Jamie, do you want to say something? Pass it over to Jamie, please. Thank you.
I think we were talking about the young people and economics, really, and how do we stop the cycle of going back into the same economic model straight away when young people are desperate for jobs at the moment. Sure. and wages are so challenged. Is how do we get over that?
Okay.
Just add to that, I've just come from a conference at the Bank of England,
right,
revisiting economics education. I'm an economist,
right,
and of course we're going to be delighted by the 2.6 growth that the Chancellor will say tomorrow. But we've gone back to the GDP model.
Right. So GDP model is part of the story, definitely. Thank you.
Hi, Paul here. I think the theme that came up from our discussion in a similar way to other discussions was the importance of influencing others. So whether that's people at school influencing their parents or the parents in choosing the economic choices through businesses and politicians. So essentially, yeah, find somebody who's more influential than you are and influence them.
Great. Thank you very much.
Hi, Dan from the UK Youth Climate Coalition. One of the things we talked about was just how the six speakers that we heard, the things that they were saying and the way that they were presenting themselves was coming across more passionately and more eloquently than most of the voices I'd say I hear normally from politics and sure. Even from professional campaigners. So in terms of creating political change, if we can somehow make more people hear those voices, that could be incredibly powerful.
Thank you very much. We have one more, I think. One more table to hear, I think.
Hi, I'm Sarah Newman. We were talking about primarily the things that the young people here said and reflecting on the amount of passion, which is very exciting. I wanted to pick up as well on emphasising the positive things. There's a lot of anger there.
Sure.
And I think, for example, these very concrete things like going back to your school, talking about what can be done on a practical day-to-day level, sure, is incredibly inspiring and makes you feel that change is possible,
sure,
rather than feeling overwhelmed by the disappointment that we are as awful as we are.
Sure. Okay. Great. Thank you very much. So I can sort of round up before giving to friends here. The issue is... this issue of being positive or negative comes up a lot with climate change. It's a real challenge. On the one hand, it's a really dire, dark, difficult existential threat to the whole world. There's a sense of apocalypse, of the end of the world, there's floods, there's fear, blah, blah. On the other hand, there's visions of the future that are much more positive, inspiring even. The challenge is to, and I'll quote Sian Ferguson, who helps to support this work, who speaks about being authentically positive. And it's a really useful expression. By authentically positive, we mean being positive while keeping it real. So knowing that it's difficult, knowing that it can be dark, knowing it's real and serious, knowing it's a threat, but managing to keep that sense of being upbeat and actually thinking of how we can actually make progress as well. Okay, so I want to hear from others, to round up your final thoughts, please, on what you feel about this evening and how we might take things forward. Miriam, if you want to go first. Well, no, actually, no, Miriam, you ended last time. So, Jolo, let's go to the other side. Sorry.
I just think it's really important that climate change isn't seen by itself. I think it's just one of lots of injustices in the world, and I think you have to fight all of them at the same time. Otherwise, it looks like you don't care about other issues. And yeah, I think it's important to see things as a whole.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I guess what you were saying earlier and what the lady here just said about actually having practical solutions, use your anger and use your passion to do something constructive and to inspire other people. So, yeah.
I would say that I think it's important to, while being optimistic as I am, it is important to highlight what is wrong at the same time. So we shouldn't lose sight of what the problems are, and then definitely tempering that with a lot of optimism that change is happening, and I think more of those stories need to be showcased.
I think my end point would just be to say that collectively we are so, so powerful, and that there is a climate movement that is emerging that we can all be part of, and I hope that you'll join the movement. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay. I have a lot of people to thank before we end up. The people I want to thank include our speakers. So I want to thank Brody Clark, Molly McNamara, Erin Green, Louis Merton, Kobir Ahmed. I also want to thank Miriam Wilson, Gitika Barwaj, Caitlin Falasco, and Jolo. First of all, our speakers. Thank you. And secondly, just these things don't come out of nowhere. So to thank people who are behind this. So thank you to RSA Fellows who make these events possible. Thank you to the Climate Change Collaboration. Thank you to RSA Academies for making this possible with our speakers. Thank you to Abby for organising it. That did not always get mentioned, but Abby put an awful lot of work into this, Abby Stevenson. So I want to thank the people who organised it. And thank you all for coming, and good night.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.